Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, today we continue now with the study of the Sutta Nipata, and we come to the Sutta number 9 in the minor chapter. This is called the King Sila Sutta, and the English translation of the title is given as Right Conduct. But as we will see, the theme of the sutta is not simply right conduct in general, but it is the right conduct that's to be observed in practicing in order to reach what's called the highest good, the highest well-being, or the highest attainment. Especially it deals with the whole course of right conduct in regard to approaching teachers of the Dhamma, in treating teachers, and in relating to the Dhamma, and in undertaking the practice of the Dhamma. So even though the word sila often has the meaning simply of morality or right moral conduct, here the word sila is given a broader meaning. So it covers the whole course of right behavior in relation to accepting the Dharma, undertaking the practice of Dhamma, and using the Dhamma in order to achieve realization of the goal. And so, even though the title of the sutta suggests that the sutta is going to focus only on the foundational stage of practice, that is morality, but when we actually look at the content of the sutta, we see that this little sutta of just 7 verses gives us a very concise presentation of the whole path of practice from the very beginning stage of approaching a teacher up to the highest stage of realization with wisdom. Okay, we start off at the beginning, and the sutta begins with a question which, according in the Pali text, the question is simply phrased as a question and then it's followed by an answer. But the commentary tells us that the question was posed by the Venerable Sariputta. And there's a story given in the commentary which explains why Venerable Sariputta is posing these questions to the Buddha. Because the Venerable Sariputta was the Buddha's chief disciple, the one who was most distinguished in wisdom. So you might wonder, why is a monk like Sariputta asking such basic questions of the Buddha? According to the story of the commentary, there was a young man who had been a friend of Venerable Sariputta when the two of them were laymen. And this young man, they both came from Brahmin families, very wealthy, well-established Brahmin families. And this young man had heard that his old friend Sariputta had left the household life and became a monk under the Buddha. And so this young man was so impressed that he too decided to give up all of his wealth and go forth and become a monk under the Buddha. And so he abandoned his wealth, became ordained as a monk, and he was assigned by the Buddha to the Venerable Sariputta as his teacher. And Venerable Sariputta gave him instructions on how to practice and to train his mind in meditation. But this young, newly ordained monk now, he tried to practice, and Venerable Sariputta tried to instruct him in one way, another way, still another way. But no matter what way this newly ordained monk practiced, he couldn't achieve any state of higher attainments. And so Venerable Sariputta wondered that there must be some kind of obstruction, inward obstruction, that was preventing him from making progress. But even though Venerable Sariputta was the chief disciple in wisdom, but he wasn't able to read very deeply into this young monk's stream of the mind and to see what were the deep hidden defilements that were blocking his progress. And so Sariputta thought the only solution is to bring him to the Buddha. And then in the presence of the Buddha, I'll ask the appropriate questions about how one should begin the practice, undertake the practice, and continue with the practice in order to reach the highest goal. And so Sariputta took this young man to the Buddha, and then Sariputta himself asked these questions in the presence of the Buddha, hoping to draw out from the Buddha the right answers. And so the sutta begins when Sariputta is asking these questions of the Buddha. And I think this is my understanding, the reason why this young man couldn't make any progress with Sariputta as his teacher, probably because when they were householders, the two of them were good friends. And so now, even though Sariputta had become the chief disciple of the Buddha, the disciple with the most excellent attainments of wisdom, but because they were friends in the past, he didn't have that special respect for Sariputta. But he would always look at Sariputta as the one who was my pal, my buddy, when we were teenagers, when we were growing up together. And so in order to be able to really practice very earnestly, one has to have a certain distance from the person that one takes as one's teacher. If the person that one regards as the teacher is a person who had been formerly a friend, then there's too much of a sense of closeness and intimacy. And so I think that's what was blocking this young man's progress. Okay, so Sariputta poses the questions, and he says, I take the Pali questions. King Silo, King Samacharo, Kani Kamani Bruhayang, Naro Sama Nivitasa, Uttamatancha Papune. So he says, a person of what kind of behavior, of what conduct, performing what actions will be well established and attain the ultimate goal, the highest goal? Okay, so those are the questions. And then the Buddha is going to answer in a very gradual, step-by-step way. He says, he should be one who honors his elders. Okay, this establishes the first condition, very essential condition. This lays down the condition as respect for those who are one's elders. And hereby the word elders doesn't necessarily mean those who are older in years, but it can mean those who are more developed than oneself. The commentary gives the meaning of Vada, those who are elders, as meaning those who are can be superior to oneself in terms of wisdom, in terms of learning, in terms of virtuous qualities, as well as in terms of years. And so, in order to progress on the path of practice, one has to have this quality of respect and reverence for those that one is relating to as one's teachers and guides on the path. And this, I'd say, is in an extremely important factor that we have to emphasize today, because I don't want to seem anti-American, but in our American democratic society, we are too prone to emphasize in the practice of Buddhism that everybody is equal, we're all on the same level, and so there's no need to have any special reverence or respect for anybody else. So somebody might have been practicing and studying the Dhamma for 50 years, trained and under the best teachers, and somebody else has comes along and he's just read a few books on Buddhism on his own over the last few weeks, and the elder who's trained for 50 years under the best teachers expresses one opinion, and I've read a few books for a few weeks. I just started to read about Buddhism a few weeks ago. I've read a few books by some Western interpreters of Buddhism, so I've picked up some of their opinions, so I form my view. And since we're all equal, and the elder expresses his opinion, I have my opinion, my view is just as good as his, why should I have any special respect or reverence for him? Right? Just as when we go to vote, he casts one vote for the president, for senator. He casts one vote, I cast one vote, we all get one vote. So in the field of Buddhism, it seems, we all should also, likewise, we also have one vote. But maybe the rule of one person, one vote applies in political elections. But if we want to make progress in the Buddhist path, that rule doesn't apply. It's not that the elders go saying, we want to have more power, we want to have more authority, but rather, from our standpoint as students, as practitioners, for us to develop, we have to eliminate this block or obstacle of thinking, I am the one who knows. I am the authority. I am the know-it-all, the ultimate authority on Buddhism. And so in order to make progress, in a sense, we have to empty our mind and make our mind very low and humble by having this respect for the elders. And then towards our fellow students, fellow practitioners, We have to have a mind which is free from envy. That's the second quality that's emphasized here. That is, sometimes our fellow practitioners will have qualities that are superior to ourselves. And so when we see this, we shouldn't become envious of them and feel that we're in a kind of contest with the teacher, that we're in a contest in the eyes of the teacher, that we are competing with our fellow students to see who's going to win the favor, the admiration of the teacher. Ah, I'm smarter and more studious than my fellow students. I know all of the answers. When the teacher asks a question, I have my hand up first. And then if somebody else knows the answers, I don't become upset and angry and envious. But rather, I try to develop an attitude of, we call this mudita, of altruistic joy, or anumodana, rejoicing with the good qualities of others. If I see that other people have kindness, then I rejoice in that quality. If I see that my fellow students are more diligent than I am, then I rejoice in their diligence. And so in this way, we develop this mind of appreciation for the good qualities and virtues of our fellow Dhamma students. And this helps again to break down this wall of separation that we erect between ourselves and others. And then the Buddha mentions a third quality, and that is knowing the right time for seeing the teachers. Kalanyu chasa garunang dasanaya. Like some people, when they choose somebody as a teacher, then they always want to be in the presence of the teacher. And so they try following the teacher all the time, always trying to create every opportunity to be in the presence of the teacher. And then they develop a relationship of extreme dependence on the teacher, as if their whole being depends upon seeing the teacher. This is turning the teacher into the object of a kind of guru cult. Always thinking that their own ability to progress in the spiritual life depends upon getting some special grace, some special transmission from the teacher. This is an approach to the spiritual life emphasized very much in the Brahminic tradition, that one is supposed to sit around in the presence of the teacher, and the teacher just sits quietly transmitting his grace to the student. But this is very different from the approach emphasized in true Buddha Dhamma, which stresses the importance of the students to take responsibility for their own progress. But the teacher is still important in that the teacher is the one who points out the path and gives guidance in following the path. And so one still should, from time to time, seek out the teacher in order to get instructions, in order to check on one's own progress with the teacher. But when one does so, one has to know the right time for doing so, not imposing on the teacher, not taking up too much of the teacher's time. and not thrusting oneself upon him at times which are maybe inconvenient for him. In our modern times, we can contact the teacher in advance, make an appointment by telephone to see him. In ancient times, when the sutta was spoken, the advice given would be to find out what is the time when the teacher might be sitting quietly, not occupied with anything, expecting pupils to come to him and to pose their questions and discuss their problems. Usually, for example, say in the monasteries, the meditation monasteries in Sri Lanka, the teachers would have certain fixed hours when they're available for consultation by their pupils. And then there would be certain times, fixed times, when the teacher gives discourses, Dhamma talks. And at those times, the text says, one should listen attentively to the well-spoken words of the teacher. Here the translation given is the discourses well preached by him. And it's very important to stress these words, to listen attentively. That is, the mind should not be straying here or there, but one should be listening carefully, respectfully. And nowadays, the very useful way to fix one's attention is by taking notes. Because when one takes notes, that will ensure that one can remember the important points in the discourse. If one doesn't take notes, unless one has a very good memory, then the important points of the discourse will just slip away and be forgotten. Okay, the next verse, 326, that's verse number 3, again repeats basically the same point made in the previous verse. Kalena gache garunang sakasang. One should go to the presence of the teachers at the right time. And then it speaks about the right attitude to adopt when one comes into the presence of the teachers. It says that one should, I don't like be obedient as a translation, rather, let me just take it literally, tambang nirankatva nivata vuti. One should discard stubbornness or obstinacy and be humble in one's manner or conduct. This obstinacy or stubbornness is a kind of manner or attitude that arises from pride or conceit, the kind of attitude that I know best, I know what is good for myself, I know how to practice the path all on my own. In order for the instructions of a teacher to be truly beneficial, one has to open oneself up to the guidance, the advice of a teacher. And that means one has to put aside this kind of stubbornness or obstinacy of the mind, the sense that I know best. And in one's attitude, one adopts this sense of humility, of softness and gentleness of mind. And then in one's manner, one's behavior, one shows humility. In the monasteries in Sri Lanka, generally in the Theravada tradition, whenever a student comes to the presence of the teacher, the student always bows down to the teacher. This doesn't mean that one regards the teacher as a deity, but it's a simple gesture of respect or reverence and a way of making oneself humble in the presence of the teacher. And then when one bows down, one says, O kasahang bhante, ahang bhante, O kasahang bhante, vandami. That is, I pay homage to you, Venerable Sir. O kasa vandami bhante. Please, I pay homage to you, Venerable Sir. And then through that act of bowing down, it's lowering one's sense of ego, dropping one's sense of self. And then that, even though it's often just a formal gesture, but it helps to open one's mind up to receive instructions. Okay, then the text says, continues. It's a little difficult here to translate this in any satisfactory way. Atang tamang sanyamang brahmacharyang anusare cheva samachare cha. Here we have four words. The translation only catches three of them. Let him remember and practice four things. The four things are the meaning, the teaching or doctrine, self-restraint, and then brahmacharya, which the translator has translated virtue, which is very not really satisfactory at all. Brahmacharya could be taken to mean celibacy in a narrow sense. And more broadly, it means the whole spiritual life. And so what one has to remember, bear in mind and recollect is the meaning of the teaching. That's the first thing, atang. Then Dhammang is the principle, that is the doctrine itself, the Dhamma that's being taught. Then beyond the meaning and principle, one has to know restraint, that is how to restrain oneself, to restrain one's conduct, bodily and verbal actions, and to restrain one's mind. Then the fourth quality, in the narrow sense, means celibacy, but more broadly, as I said, it means the whole spiritual life. It can be taken to incorporate the entire Noble Eightfold Path. And so what's being emphasized here is the need to practice the whole Eightfold Path as a comprehensive system of spiritual training. And so this is the instruction that one receives from the teacher, that one recollects and puts into practice. Then the Buddha says, one who rejoices in the Dhamma, one who delights in the Dhamma, one who is well established in the Dhamma and who knows how to form judgments based on the Dhamma. Such a one does not engage in any kind of speech or in any kind of debates that cast a blemish on the Dhamma, but instead passes his time with true, well-spoken words. Okay, according to the commentary here, by Dhamma, in this verse, is meant the two practices of samadhi meditation and insight meditation. So now the practitioner is moving on to the development of tranquility and insight meditation. And so one who is engaged in the practice of developing these two types of meditation doesn't want to become engaged in any kind of speech that is going to distract from the development of the meditative mind. Any kind of gossip, any kind of idle chatter, any kind of licentious speech. Because when one engages in that kind of speech, then the mind becomes defiled. And when the mind becomes defiled, then all of the pure qualities, the wholesome qualities that one has been strengthening and developing through the practice of meditation, those wholesome qualities start to weaken and disappear. And so when one is in the early stages of developing whether tranquility meditation or insight meditation, one has to be very careful of one's speech. One has to be restrained in speech and speak only what is true and what is of benefit to others and to oneself. Then the next verse mentions some types of speech and states of mind that one has to avoid. It mentions one should abandon laughter. Maybe you think, oh, this Buddhism, it's a very pessimistic, very grim, gloomy religion. We can't even laugh. No, it doesn't mean that one can't laugh a little bit or lightly, but what has to be given up is the kind of unrestrained or hysterical laughter, the kind of laughter that comes from, you know, cracking jokes and just, well, I crack jokes too sometimes. But just, you call this idle or pointless laughter, just to amuse oneself. Then gossip. Then paridevang, is here he's translated, said complaining, but usually this is translated as lamentation, weeping and wailing when one suffers some kind of loss or misery. Then padosang is hatred, ill will. Then comes deception, hypocrisy, greed. Then he missed one, conceit. Then comes spite, or again, obstinacy. Then bad temper, impurity, and what he translates attachment, I think infatuation, or obsession would be better. And then the last one is pride or intoxication. Intoxication with one's beauty, with one's strength, with one's achievements. Okay, all of these are the unwholesome states of mind that one has to try to overcome. And instead, one has to have titatto, which means a steady, well-established mind. That is a mind which is firm and unshakable. Okay, so now the text has taught us the kinds of speech that one should avoid, the kinds of mental states one should overcome. And now the Buddha goes on to state the way in which instruction is going to lead on to the higher states of mind. He says, Vinyata sarani subhasitani sutancha vinyatang samadhi sarang. It's a very beautiful pair of lines. That the essence of well-spoken words is understanding. So, when one receives good advice, good discourses from a teacher, then the purpose of those words is to generate understanding. But that understanding that is produced in the mind through listening to the good words of the teacher, that has as its purpose samadhi or concentration. And so the next line says, the essence of learning, the essence of what one hears, because in the Buddha's time, in order to learn, one has to listen. So the essence of learning and of understanding is samadhi, concentration. Because one learns the Dhamma in order to learn how to develop samadhi, concentration. How to train the mind in order to overcome the distractions and disturbances of the mind, and how to unify the mind and bring the mind into the state of absorption or samadhi. But for one who is, the translation says hasty, but a better translation maybe is impulsive. For one who is impulsive and negligent, for a person like this, the wisdom and learning do not increase. That is, if a person just acts on impulse, and doesn't pay any attention to the instructions, then they're not going to gain any benefit from listening. And when they don't listen, then their wisdom is not going to increase, and they won't have any kind of wisdom to use for developing samadhi. But the next line explains now how a person goes on to develop their learning in order to reach the ultimate goal. The verse says, those who delight in the Dhamma, in the teaching taught by the noble ones, are unexcelled in their speech, in their mind, and in their conduct. Okay, this shows that they have excellent or perfect virtue of body, speech, and mind. Then they become established in peace, gentleness, and samadhi, concentration. And then they obtain the essence of learning and wisdom. The commentary explains here that when they purify their bodily actions and their speech and their minds, then they become established in samadhi. When they're established in samadhi, then they develop wisdom. They attain the essence of wisdom and of learning. And by attaining the essence of learning and of wisdom, then they attain peace, which here means the peace of Nibbana. So in this way, by following all of these steps in sequence, starting from the very first step of having respect for elders, approaching teachers at the right time, one is able to move on all the ways right up to the attainment of the ultimate goal of the Dhamma. Okay, this will be my talk for the afternoon. I thank you all for your attention, and may the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you all. Okay, we share, end by sharing the merit.